Okay, quiet on set.
Now, back to the Horsepower for an Hour show with Donnie and Spence.
Roll 'em.
Our next guest is the proud owner of not one, but two 1927 Chryslers. He's a well-known actor appearing on the Rifleman reruns on memorable TV on cable. We'll discuss his acting career, his musical career, and his vintage Chryslers. Johnny Crawford is a character actor, a singer, a musician, and a band leader. At age 12, Johnny became famous for playing Mark McCain, the son of Lucas McCain, who was played by Chuck Connors in the popular ABC Western, The Rifleman, which originally aired from 1958 to 1963. His first performance before a national audience was one of Disney's original Mouseketeers in 1955. Today, Johnny is the leader of the Johnny Crawford Orchestra, whose album Sweeping the Clouds Away is an Amazon top-rated album in seven different categories. Joining us from Southern California, welcome to Horsepower for an Hour with our hosts Donnie Cacciamese and Tom Spence. How are you today, Johnny?
I'm just great. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. And I guess we'll start with the automobiles if we can here, because each of our listeners has a real love affair with cars. And you're very fortunate to have fallen in love twice with two 1927 Chryslers.
Actually, 1930 Chryslers.
I'm sorry, 1930 Chryslers. Even better.
Uh-huh.
So how does a baby boomer like you fall in love with a car from a generation like the 1930 Chrysler?
Well, you know, I've always loved the period of the 1920s, and the period between the two world wars. I think it was there were so many dramatic changes, but also, to me, it was at the peak of artistic creativity in so many fields, architecture, music, and literature. It was a very unique and very short period of time. You know, the music and the... between the two world wars, 1920s and 1930s, was very peculiar to that time, and you don't hear it today. They don't play it on the radio. If you have the services that provide, you know, on-the-air music in your car, you can select all kinds of different music, and then they give you the decades, the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, and then they might say the 1940s, but I think they just call that big band, and they just don't offer the 20s and 30s. There are occasionally programs on some of those stations that present that music, but people live and die without ever hearing some of this wonderful music. And I've always loved the dance band recordings that I first found when I was a very young kid. And because four of my grandparents were musicians and made their living with music, my father's father was a song plugger in the teens and then a successful music publisher in the 20s. My other grandfather was a violinist, a concertmaster of the New York Philharmonic at one time. And my mother was always playing the piano and playing really great music. She loved Chopin, and she didn't play popular songs until I put the music in front of her, but she loved doing that. And I discovered when I was very young, maybe 3 or 4 years old, these old 78s, and most of them were either classical music or dance band recording. And the dance band era really took off after World War One, and the Foxtrot and then in 1923, the Charleston came along. There was the Black Bottom and all these other dances. But the music that you heard in those days was always live until 1922, when commercial radio opened up. And the first thing they did was to put microphones, although in 22 they really didn't have microphones. They were still using horns to capture the sound and put it on the air. And they just would go to restaurants and dance halls and put a couple of horns in front of the band, and that music was heard throughout the country, and all these local stations, independent radio stations, popped up in towns all over the continent. And then, of course, in the 1920s, they started to be banded together with networks, and they would present music for 15 minutes from one ballroom or restaurant to another, and everywhere you went, there was this wonderful dance music. And There were great songwriters and musicians everywhere. Songwriting came out of New York, but there were people all over. It blossomed during the 1920s, and there was great inventiveness in those recordings.
Well, there was. I mean, that was the era of Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, the Cohan brothers. I mean, there were lots and lots of great performers, great music coming out at that time. And you think that the automobiles from that period were just as symbolic of the 20s and the 30s as the music was?
Yes, and the interesting thing is that so many of the manufacturers of automobiles at the beginning were companies that made carriages. And Studebaker, they made covered wagons in the 1840s, long before they started making cars. So when the combustible engine came along, they attached them to the framework that had already been around for hundreds of years. And the coachwork in the 1800s was very sophisticated. Besides the wagons, they built beautiful coaches for wealthy people and taxis, and it was a very romantic atmosphere, and architecture was very creative during that time. And also there were so many private businesses in those days. There were startup businesses all over the country. Cars weren't just made in Detroit. There were companies in Oklahoma and Indiana and California making automobiles, and not very many of them lasted because the competition weeded out the ones that weren't as popular. And then after the crash, a whole bunch of well-established companies like Packard and Duesenberg and Pierce Arrow, the Playboy, they disappeared. And the only reason that Chrysler succeeded, and Chrysler was one of the last of the major car companies to come along, the others, you know, General Motors, Ford, Studebaker, Packard, they all were, and of course Mercedes-Benz, they were all well established by 1910. The last one to come along, I was going to say, was the Chrysler, and that was 1923, I believe.
Well, Johnny, this is Donnie Cacciamissi, host of Horsepower for an Hour. Let me take it back to your 1930 Chryslers. Now, neither of those cars was located in Southern California when you originally purchased it. And you've got some amusing stories of how you brought those cars into California. Will you share some of those with us?
Well, actually, the first one was actually in California. And I was very lucky. I got a 1930 Model 70 Royal Sedan. With four doors and beautiful coachwork and all the decorative items like the headlights and the cowl lamps and the instrument panel were designed by Cartier. And that was a very unique thing to that time. Starting, I think, about 1927 or 28, they started putting the instruments and the dash panel, they started putting them in a fancy framework. All the different manufacturers, and prior to that, they were just holes in the dashboard. So that was unique, and it also appealed to me because the styling was considered very modern, but it still had trademarks of centuries-old coachwork, and I just liked that. And so I was looking for an old car. I had rediscovered the music of the 20s and 30s, which I always loved, but was kind of drawn away from by contemporary music. And then I was at a friend's house in 1972, I think, and he was playing an album that he had just gotten, which was a collection of early Bing Crosby records from the 20s, from the late 1920s, when he was just a singer, a band singer in Paul Whiteman's orchestra, and then the orchestra at the Coconut Grove in Los Angeles. Can't think of that orchestra's name. But I fell in love with those recordings and hadn't heard them before. They weren't in my stack of 78s when I was 4 years old. And I said, who's that singer? You know, in those days, it was all about the band leader was the star, and the singers were just sidemen like the reed players and the horns. And they would have a chorus, one chorus, and then it was all about the orchestration And there were wonderful orchestrations. Some of them were very difficult to read because they were so creative. And they started toning them down in the 1930s because they were getting complaints from high schools that they were too hard to read. But they were very creative and with key changes and interludes and very rich. And I was told that the vocalist on that album was Bing Crosby, and I ran out and got the album, and I started learning those songs on the guitar and enjoying them. Before that, I was focusing on folk music, which I still love, and then I deserted that when I started learning the chords that were necessary to play these dance band songs. So I wanted to live that period, so I started looking for an automobile to help me get there, and I decided I would look for a Packard. And in the early 70s, there were still many cars in the Times classified section from the 1920s and 30s. There were dozens of them. And I was going down the list and looking, you know, doing some research to see what they looked like and what I wanted to look for. And one weekend, there was, among all the listings, there was a 1930 Chrysler listed. And I hadn't really noticed any old Chryslers being offered before. And this car was in Los Angeles. It was in East Los Angeles, I think, and it had 43,000 miles on it, and it was sold to a dealer in Eureka, California in 1929, and the dealer gave that car to his wife, and she only used it to drive back and forth from their home to the grocery store, or, you know, small, it was a not used that much. So by the time I came onto it, it only had those 43,000 miles, and I was getting it from the second owner.
Boy, that's remarkable.
Yeah, it was remarkable.
Crazy. 43,000 miles to and from work. That's
It had always been covered at night, always been in a garage, and the only thing was that the brakes were not very good. In fact, they were very weak, but it had a handbrake that had its own flywheel behind the transmission and would clamp down on that flywheel. I could slow down the car using the handbrake. And so I drove it home and just stayed, gave myself enough room to stop. And I was crazy, but I managed to get it to a mechanic, and he fixed the brakes. And I was riding around in this 1930 sedan at night, listening to dance band records from the 1920s and early 30s from a cassette player that was on the seat next to me.
Wow, that's crazy. We're going to get to your music in just a little bit, Johnny. This is Tom Spence with Horsepower for an Hour. If we could jump back to the television and look at what... I was raised in Thousand Oaks, so a lot of the Westerns were filmed around there. I got to get a lot of that when I was a real little kid there in the 60s and see that. So best known as your role in The Rifleman as Mark McCain. Let's talk about some of that for a 12-year-old kid and the amount of viewers that show had. What was that like?
Well, it was very exciting. I had been acting for a while, and I did a play when I was 5 years old in Hollywood and got the acting bug immediately. And my Sunday school teacher turned out to be a successful Hollywood agent and wanted to represent me and my brother. And my mother didn't want us to get involved, but I begged them to let me go on auditions. And my mother, I would pull her away from her piano, but after school, and sometimes even before school, there would be a note sent to my classroom that I had to leave early to go on an audition. And I started getting things after my first successful audition was for the Mouseketeers in 1955. And they started out with 25 or 26 Mouseketeers. Mm-hmm. And they decided very soon that they couldn't handle that many. We were pretty rambunctious. I remember we would come, you know, and do 3 hours of schooling, and then some of us would be pulled for some filming or rehearsals. But after schooling, if they weren't using us, we were, you know, taking over the studio, and they got wise eventually and locked us in a screening room and ran cartoons when they didn't need us. But they let half of us go after the first season because of that, and I was one of those that was dismissed and brokenhearted. But my agent sent me out on other auditions, and I started getting small parts, and pretty soon I was working constantly, and from throughout 1956 and 57, hoping to get an audition for a Western. And every time I'd got one, they said I wasn't the Western type or something, and that really deflated me. I wanted to do Westerns more than anything. And then one day, my mother picked me up after school, and she had some Western clothes for me to put on in the back seat, and we were going on an audition to Culver City, to the Hal Roach Studios, and it was a pilot for a series, and it turned out to be The Rifleman, and I got it, and it was a dream come true for me. I just couldn't imagine being any happier than playing a cowboy and acting. I loved acting.
And when you're playing with somebody like Chuck Connors, I mean, we know a little bit about Chuck Connors. So what was your relationship with him? I mean, this was a man that was an actor. He was an athlete. He had, mm-hmm. you know, so much going on. What was your relationship with Chuck Connors? How was that?
Well, it was terrific. We became very close. And he always treated me as an equal. He never talked down to me. He never treated me like a child. He made me feel like an adult, and I learned a lot from him. I thought he was a great actor, and each year that he didn't get nominated for an Emmy, I was disturbed because I thought he was giving such wonderful performances, and we remained good friends over the years until he passed away in 1992.
Our guest is Johnny Crawford, and we are talking on Horsepower for an Hour. Johnny, before we get too far away from the acting, just one quick question on the Disney Club. What was it like working for Walt Disney? He's always been one of my idols.
Well, he was certainly one of my idols, and still is. When I was a kid, I was a big fan of the weekly Sunday show, Disneyland. And I remember when everybody was singing Davy Crockett. So going on the audition was very exciting. Then being chosen to be a Mouseketeer was a dream come true. Two things I wanted most at that time in my life was to be a cowboy and to be a tap dancer.
A tap dancer?
Wow. Yeah.
The two things didn't seem to go together, but...
hey, Donald O'Connor and Chuck Connors, come on.
Yeah,
Donald
O'Connor was my hero. I thought he was terrific. I appreciated Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, but, you know, Donald O'Connor was unlike anybody else.
And you had Sammy Davis Jr. on an episode once, and he was a heck of a tap dancer. So
sure was.
You were around this all the time.
Yeah, I was very lucky, and Sammy loved Westerns, and he met Chuck at some event. He told Chuck how he wanted to do Western, how he loved Westerns, and he was a fast draw expert. So
I remember the episode.
Yeah, well, there were two of them, actually, and he was great fun to work with. He was just like a kid, and so was Chuck. Chuck had a great sense of humor. It was kind of off the wall, you know, and he was very intimidating to a lot of people because he was so big. He was very gregarious, but he was so much fun to work with because of that, you know. It was never dull, and he and Sammy just got along great. They did
from the Rifleman to the Candyman. Hey, can we play your music? Can we roll out a tune here? I would love to go with a song for us. And so I'm going to play a tune from Johnny Crawford. Here we go.
Don't go around moping, hoping happiness will come. That's not the way. It doesn't pay. If you want happiness, help yourself to some. Why don't you try to take life the way I do? Let the whole world sigh or cry. I'll be high in the sky, up on top of a rainbow, sweeping the clouds away.
You know, another thing that's great about this music, Johnny, is the use of the banjo in a big band back then that has completely disappeared. That Django, back then it was Django Reinhardt, now it's Django Unchained. What happened to us?
Well, you know, the banjo was used as a rhythm instrument, and it couldn't be, you know, a guitar couldn't be heard in a dance hall unless there was a megaphone in front of it, and I suppose sometimes there were. I have a photograph of a band in the early 20s or maybe even the late teens, and they have megaphones in front of the instrument, you know. And it's really interesting how that evolved. But when the electric microphone came along in 1925, and it revolutionized the recording technique, of course, and musicians started using guitars, especially Eddie Lang, and others who were very well known at that time and working really much just in New York because they were the top musicians wanted by all the recording companies. And Eddie Lang and Joe Venuti, the violinist, made wonderful records together, especially in 1927 when they did some duos on record. Those were for years very rare and a very hot collector's item. Now, of course, they're all available on CD, and we're spoiled. In the 1950s and 60s, even right after those records were made, they would press only so many of them, and they were recording so prolifically that they didn't bother to make more copies of things.
Yeah, it became very difficult to find it, didn't it?
Right. Record collecting in the 1930s was a big deal, and Bing Crosby, when he was still just a dance band singer, he mentioned in his biography, he sold his Bix records and his Eddie Lang, Venuti Lang records after gigs. People would gather, you know, late at night after the band was done and trade records, and it was quite a thing.
Well, Johnny, we're just about out of time. I'm getting a nod from our producer. Before we leave, where can our listeners go to find out more information about what's going on with Johnny Crawford today?
Well, the easiest thing is to go to Twitter, twitter.com/ Johnny Crawford. And I have a Facebook page, and the events are all listed on my Facebook page. I'm easy to find, and I'm... Thanks to MeTV, I'm pretty busy because the show is being shown. They show two episodes every day at dinner time, and it's just wonderful. I couldn't be more lucky. I'm making appearances and traveling all over the country promoting this first album and working on the next one.
Thank you so much for being our guest here today on Horsepower for an Hour, spending a little time with us, sharing some of the old days and even some of the new times with us. Johnny, thanks so much. We'll see you down the road.
Thank you.